Thank you, Father. Reverend clergy, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Before I begin my presentation on the Society of St. Pius V and the Tuk bishops here tonight, I have a confession to make. I have to reveal something to you. Please keep this to yourselves. Don't repeat it. I actually have three things in common with Benedict the 16th. The first thing I have in common with Benedict the 16th is that, like him, I am originally from Germany. So we share the same country of origin. It gets worse. The second thing I have in common with Benedict the 16th is we share the same birthday. And I'm reminded of that every year. But the third thing I have in common with Benedict the 16th is something I am proud of. And that is, I am not the Pope either. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Reverend clergy, we have no Pope. And because of this, we said of Acantis, are caught up in all sorts of disagreements and controversies. Some of them are necessary and legitimate, and others are not. In my opinion, the controversy about the Tuk bishops is totally needless and not legitimate. It is basically a waste of time because I believe the facts are very clear. I brought you a PowerPoint presentation. And I'd like to begin the presentation by introducing you to some of the people and the events involved. So we will begin, of course, with Bishop Pierre-Martin Ngodin Tuk. And there you can see a photo of him. I think I'm going to take the microphone here. Bishop Tuk was born on October 6, 1897, in Hue, Vietnam. He was the brother of Ngo Dinh Diem, the first president of South Vietnam, who was assassinated, I believe it was in 1963, during the Second Vatican Council. Bishop Tuk was consecrated a bishop by order of Pope Pius XI. On May 4th, 1938, and Bishop Tuk died in the United States in Carthage, Missouri, on December 13th, 1984. As far as the Episcopal consecrations of 1981, these are really the Tuk consecrations that we're always talking about. This is a photograph of the Dominican theologian and mathematician, Bishop Gerard de Laurier. He was consecrated by Bishop Tuk to the episcopacy on May 7th, 1981. And this took place in Bishop Tuk's residence in Toulon, France. Bishop de Laurier died in February of 1988. He consecrated His Excellency Bishop McKenna on August 22nd, 1986, and I believe one or two other bishops. Then there was another Episcopal consecration in 1981, and that was Father Adolfo Zamora and Father Moises Carmona. They were both Mexicans. And that was on October 17th, 1981. Likewise, this consecration took place in the residence of Bishop Tuk in Toulon, France. And Bishop Zamora died in 1987, and Bishop Carmona, very tragically, in a car accident on All Saints Day in 1991. then let me give you a few facts on the Society of St. Pius V. I am using the term loosely here for my presentation because there is also a Congregation of St. Pius V, which was founded in 1996 by Bishop Clarence Kelly, and they're technically two separate orders, two separate societies, but for purposes of this presentation, we can just consider them one and the same. The Society of St. Pius V was established in 1983, and that was really with the dismissal of the Nine from the Society of St. Pius X. The Society of St. Pius V has distinguished itself as being really the fiercest opponents of the 1981 two consecrations and any subsequent consecrations and ordinations in the Took lineage. The Society of St. Pius V and Congregation of St. Pius V consists of the following clergy. We have Bishop Clarence Kelly, Bishop Joseph Sante, Father William Jenkins, Father Martin Skirky, Father Paul Skirky, Father Paul Baumberger, Father James Curatolo, Father James Carroll, Father Matthew Newman, Father Joseph Greenwell, Father Thomas Mrochka, and Father Benjamin Selway. And I hope I didn't forget anybody. Their headquarters are in Round Top, New York. That's in the Catskill area. As regards the person of Bishop Clarence Kelly, he was born in 1941 and ordained a priest by Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre for the Society of St. Pius X on April 14, 1973, at Econe, Switzerland. He co-founded the Society of St. Pius V in 1983, and he founded the Daughters of Mary in 1984. Bishop Kelly was himself consecrated a bishop by Bishop Alfred Mendez on October 19, 1993 in Carlsbad, California. This consecration was kept secret until the death of Bishop Mendez in 1995. And lastly, Bishop Kelly founded, as I already said, this Congregation of St. Pius V in 1996. And all the ordinations that he has done were for clergy in the Congregation of St. Pius V in 1996. So really, the Society of St. Pius V will cease to exist once the last cleric there is deceased. And it will only be the Congregation of St. Pius V. At this point, I would like to ask you to please pray for Bishop Kelly, because he is very ill. I saw a recent picture of him, and he looked very gaunt. And if you could just, in your charity, pray for him. We certainly don't wish him any ill, and I think he would benefit greatly from our prayers. I next want to talk about Bishop Kelly's book, The Sacred and the Profane, which was written by Bishop Kelly. It was published in 1997, and it was considered the Society of St. Pius V's definitive answer to the Took bishops, outlining their case against the consecrations and related issues, and it was also a defense of Bishop Kelly's own consecration by Bishop Mendez in 1993, and there's a lot of documentation on that. The title kind of gives it away. Guess who's the sacred? Guess who's the profane? Okay. Or which orders are considered sacred and which orders are considered profane? You can actually, you don't have to get a hard copy of the book. You can actually get it for free online from the Society of St. Pius V, from their own website. And it is available as a PDF file, and you can even search for keywords. So that makes it very convenient in case you should decide to get that book, which I don't recommend, unless you just want to, I mean, it's fair game. You know, get both sides, by all means. And so much for the sacred and the profane. Next, let's take a quick snapshot at Bishop Joseph Santé. He was born in 1969. He was ordained a priest by Bishop Kelly on May 4th, 2001, and consecrated a bishop on February 28th, 2007, in Oyster Bay Cove, New York. He resides at Immaculate Heart Seminary in Round Top, and he can be considered, I guess, the successor to Bishop Kelly. Now, so much for the main clergy involved here. We now need to look at the questions that we want to investigate. We'll break it down into three sections. We first have to consider the question of fact. Does the Catholic Church require us to hold that the 1981 two consecrations took place? That's the first thing we'll have to investigate, because if we don't know that they took place, all the rest is irrelevant. Once we have established that indeed they took place, we will have to consider the question of validity. Does the Church require us to accept the 1981 consecrations as valid? And finally, once we have established that not only did they occur and were valid, we will consider their lawfulness. Were the 1981 two consecrations in accordance with church law? So let's begin with part one regarding fact. Does the church require us to hold that the two consecrations in 1981 took place? I'm going to offer you a syllogism. There'll be two premises and a conclusion. Now, I'm afraid that is probably, I don't know how easy that is to read for you. I'm going to, by the way, try to post this PowerPoint presentation on the website once I get back home to my computer. So I would like to make that available to anyone who's interested. Premise one, canon law says that facts must be proved unless they are so-called notorious facts. And that's according to Canon 1747, number one, which means that unless they are facts that are publicly known and committed in such manner that they cannot be concealed or excused. So what we're saying is that, obviously, if you're out there saying such and such has happened, of course you need to prove it. But when you don't have to prove it is when the fact is notorious, when it is so clear and so obvious that it took place, that it happened, that there's really no denying it. And the reason is quite simply that the church's law is not trying to be overly unreasonable, overly burdensome. The church's law is not useless. And it would be useless to try to prove something what everyone else already knows is true. Okay? So this is going to be our first premise. Facts have to be proved unless they are notorious. The second premise, the 1981 consecrations of bishops De Laurier, Carmona, and Zamora are notorious facts. So it will be easy to see what the conclusion is. Therefore, according to the church's law, no additional legal or formal proof is required because all the legal formalities aim to produce is certainty regarding the facts, but notorious facts are already certain. Okay, so this is going to be the basic argument. What I'm going to have to do now is prove premise number two. Premise number one is already proven because it's taken straight from the church's law. The church law says notorious facts require no additional evidence. Of course, you have to first prove that it is a notorious fact. But once that is established, there's nothing else you have to prove. And I'll explain that a little bit more in a minute. So premise two, the 1981 consecrations of bishops De Laurier, Carmona, and Zamora are notorious facts. How do we know that? Well, let's look at what evidence do we have for the consecrations. First of all, we have photos. Okay, we have photos of the ceremonies that were published in a Sedevacantist magazine in Germany. And in fact, some of them are reproduced in my study, which you can download for free online, or you can just get this beautiful paperback copy that the good sisters of the CMRI printed and bound. And they came out really beautiful. Okay, so yes, right there you can see the consecrations took place. All right, but we have more than just these photos. We have sworn testimony by Dr. Kurt Hiller and Dr. Eberhard Heller of Munich, Germany, who assisted at the consecration ceremonies. They both swore an oath and said, yes, the consecrations took place. We were there. Then we have sworn testimony by Father Noel Barbara in France. He swore an oath that Bishop Godin took, acknowledged to him in person to have performed the consecrations. Okay, Father Barbara went to visit Bishop Took, and they spoke about these things, and Father Barbara has sworn that Bishop Took acknowledged this to him. Then, of course, we have the testimony by the consecrator, Bishop Took himself, as well as the ordinants, De Laurier, Carmona, and Zamora. They all said, yes, this happened. Bishop Took consecrated as bishops, and Bishop Took said, yes, I consecrated these men. Then we have a consecration certificate for Bishop Carmona issued by Bishop Took. And that is also reproduced photographically in my study, and it's also available on the internet. And this certificate turned up after the death of Bishop Carmona in 1991. It was found among his personal files. I would imagine very much so that Bishop Took also wrote a certificate for Bishop Zamora and Bishop De Laurier, but at least as far as I know, we don't have these copies. Doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means we don't have them. Next, there's even more evidence. The Novus Ordo Vatican's official excommunication against Bishop Took for the consecrations, published around the world after a quote-unquote well-founded inquiry confirming that the consecrations occurred. Well-founded inquiry, that's straight from a letter of Cardinal Ratzinger, okay? They excommunicated Bishop Took. For what? For something that we don't even know happened? No, absurd. They looked into the matter. They found out he consecrated these men and said, okay, guess what? Here's your excommunication. And finally, and this is my personal favorite, Bishop Kelly himself acknowledges that the consecrations were performed. If he didn't, he wouldn't have anything to talk about. Right? So all of this proves our premise number two. The consecrations are notorious facts. Does anybody else have any question about these consecrations having occurred? I don't see any hands being raised, okay? I mean, it's crystal clear. Bishop Took consecrated these men, like it or not. And so the conclusion here is that we have certitude that the consecrations took place. Okay, therefore, these consecrations can be considered notorious facts, and canon law says notorious facts don't need any additional evidence, okay? This is enough. We don't need any additional signatures, notarized documents, whatnot. This is enough, okay? So we are certain that the consecrations occurred. Now, there are three kinds of certitude. We can be certain about things in different ways. The kind of certitude we have, and this gets a little bit philosophical, but it's really just common sense. It's called moral certitude. Let me explain to you quickly what moral certitude is. It's not difficult. Moral certitude, first of all, is distinguished from metaphysical and physical certitude. don't be afraid. I know this is technical terminology, but it is all, like I just said, just common sense. What is metaphysical certitude? Metaphysical certitude is the kind of certitude we have that a triangle has three sides, 1 + 1 = 2. Okay? It's infallible. There's no way this could be wrong. You will never find a triangle that doesn't have three sides. Right? It is true by definition. It could not be otherwise. In fact, not even God could change it. Right? And that's simply because it's true by definition. As long as you understand what a triangle is, you know it's going to have three sides. It's kind of like the certitude that every bachelor is unmarried. Okay? I mean, there's just no such thing as a married bachelor because that's just not what a bachelor is. All right? So this is metaphysical. This is the highest kind of certitude. Okay? Infallible, couldn't be otherwise, impossible, not even God could change it. Now, there's another kind of certitude, and that is physical certitude. And that's based on the laws of nature. Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay? As I guess Sister Metchtild would say, that's just how it is. All right? God rest her soul. Now, this is based on and known from the laws of nature. In theory, it could be otherwise if God so decreed. Okay? For example, in miracles. I mean, it is certainly conceivable that water should boil at some other temperature, right? Why not? But this is how God created it. He made water in such a way that it would boil at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. All right? And God overrides these laws when he works miracles. All right, so we have metaphysical certitude and we have physical certitude, but there's one more that we're lacking, and that is our moral certitude. What then is moral certitude? It's not metaphysical certitude, and it's not physical certitude. Moral certitude is defined as the kind of reasonable certitude that makes error impossible or very unlikely according to what is customary among mankind. For example, we are certain that George Washington existed. We don't have metaphysical certitude regarding that, and it definitely has nothing to do with the laws of nature. We don't have physical certitude about it either. But we're still kind of certain, aren't we? Well, that would be moral certitude, right? We have historical testimony, aplenty, and it would be, in theory, it would be possible that this is a gigantic conspiracy, you know, to make us all believe George Washington existed and he never did. But according to what is customary among mankind, error here would be extremely unlikely. All right? Another great example is, people will run from a burning house, right? We all agree with that, right? We are certain about that, not with metaphysical certitude, not with physical certitude, but with moral certitude. I mean, in theory, you know, yes, you could have somebody absolutely refuses to, but not according to what is customary among mankind. Now, so this moral certitude is what we have regarding the two consecrations. It suffices to know that the consecrations occurred. We don't need physical certitude, and we couldn't have that anyway, and we certainly don't need metaphysical certitude regarding the two consecrations either. We just need moral certitude. It is indeed the highest kind of certitude that can possibly be had in this matter. There's no higher. We can't have physical certitude regarding the consecrations, and we can't have metaphysical certitude. And the beauty here is that even though the church has, you know, these legal formalities that you normally have to go through in order to prove an ordination, I mean, really the normal way to ascertain that somebody was ordained would be to contact the diocese, and they look it up in the, I guess, in their offices. You know, they have a registry, and they pull out, you know, the entry and see, was he ordained or not? Well, okay, great. Granted, we don't have that for the two consecrations, and we don't have it for any traditional Catholic consecrations or ordinations either. But that's not all that important, because this moral certitude, we can still have moral certitude because it is not bound up with these legal bells and whistles per se. In other words, the legal formalities are only there to, as the ordinary way to bring about this moral certitude, okay? But they're not absolutely needed to know that the consecrations occurred. I mean, we just went through the whole list of how we know they occurred. And consider that even a legal church judgment could not produce a higher kind of certitude. Even if you had, please God, a pope who would come out and say, yes, I certify, I confirm, I verify, two consecrations occurred, they're valid, they're lawful. That wouldn't increase the kind of certitude. It would still be moral certitude. It might perhaps be a higher degree, but it would still only be moral certitude, okay? I don't mean to like beat this to death now either. I think we've covered that sufficiently. It really just stands to reason that the reason the church has all these formal legal regulations regarding that is that this is simply the ordinary way to produce this moral certitude for the people that somebody has been ordained. Now, let us, to make the same point in another way, let us, for the moment, try to argue the opposite. Let's try to argue that the consecrations did not occur. How would you do that? I mean, considering all the evidence we just went through, it would simply be absurd. Imagine yourself in front of an ecclesiastical judge trying to argue the consecrations didn't occur. And the judge shows you the photos and the certificate and the testimony and the sworn statements. And he says to you, what are you talking about? We would have to presuppose a gigantic conspiracy theory without any foundation. It would be extremely imprudent to believe that despite all this evidence that the consecrations did not occur, that somehow it was just a gigantic setup, that the witnesses were bribed and the photos were doctored. And it's possible, okay? Just like it's possible George Washington never existed, right? But it would be extremely silly to believe this, absent any evidence, and you could never prove it in an ecclesiastical court, could you? Now, the next point I want to make is consider that the church and society convict people based on moral certitude of their guilt and acquit people based on a lack of that moral certitude, okay? It's good enough for the church. It's good enough for society. It's got to be good enough for Bishop Kelly. I'm sorry. Now, Canon 1869, paragraph 1 in the Church's canon law, says that an ecclesiastical judge must make his decisions based on, want to guess? Moral certitude, Canon 1869, okay? It literally says he is required to achieve moral certitude regarding the point to be decided, okay? Not infallible metaphysical certitude, not physical certitude, just moral certitude. Pope Pius XII said in an address to the Roman Rota, which is quoted at length in my study, Pope Pius XII said, this is October 1st, 1942, he says, "An ecclesiastical judges may not deny on legal grounds what they personally know to be true through moral certitude." In other words, if you know that this is a fact, don't deny it just because of some legal mumbo-jumbo. Okay? Don't use the church's law to throw obstacles in the way of something that we know to be true. Okay? It's very reasonable. It's really just common sense. And yeah, actually, that was my next point. There is no conflict between church law and common sense. Right? In other words, the church's law is reasonable. Now, something else I want to mention is that there is ample evidence in the church's historical practice that proves that moral certitude is sufficient to accept sacraments as having taken place. There's a very good book out there. It was written by Father Eugene Sullivan. It's published by the Catholic University of America Press in 1944. And the book is called Proof of the Reception of the Sacraments. It's a very interesting book. And it was one of the first things I read when I did my research, because Bishop Kelly quotes that book, makes reference to it in his book, The Sacred and the Profane. And so I said, okay, this is a book I'm going to have to read cover to cover. I need to get the full picture. And after having finished the book, it was clear that Father Eugene Sullivan does not agree with Bishop Kelly's position. Not even close. Okay? Father Sullivan, unfortunately, I don't have a copy here. Father Sullivan's book is virtually screaming moral certitude on every page. Okay? Bishop Kelly just picked out a sentence or a paragraph or something and tried to use it to back up one of his points. But if you read the book cover to cover, and I doubt Bishop Kelly did that, then you find out, okay, this book is definitely not supporting Bishop Kelly or the Society of St. Pius V's position. All right. So anyway, enough of moral certitude. We have proved premise number two. If you remember, the premise number two was the 1981 consecrations. Took consecrations are notorious facts, right? We said notorious facts don't need any additional evidence. The took consecrations are notorious facts. Therefore, we don't need any additional evidence. We don't need any more signed documents, any additional witnesses. We're good. We have all that we need to know that they occurred. Now, the second part we want to talk about is validity. Now that we've seen that the church requires us to believe that the two consecrations occurred, we need to ask, does the church also require us to accept them as valid? Again, I'm going to give you two premises and a conclusion. That's the way to do this, right? The first premise, and we will prove this in a minute. Once we know that a sacramental ceremony has taken place, the church requires us to presume validity until the contrary is proved. Proved, mind you, not just asserted. The second premise is we know the sacramental ceremonies in question, the 1981 took consecrations, have taken place. Guess what the conclusion is? According to church teaching, we are required to believe that the 1981 consecrations were valid until someone can prove they were not. So, let me go ahead and prove premise one. Once we know that the ceremony has taken place, the church requires us to presume validity. First, I need to mention that, properly speaking, no sacrament can ever be proved valid. It can only be presumed valid. Sometimes we might perhaps speak about proving a sacrament valid, but really what we mean is that we've only proven that we must presume it to be valid. Why is it that a sacrament can never be proved valid? It's because there's no empirical evidence possible to verify validity, right? There's nothing we can point to, say, for example, to a baptism and say, oh, here, look at this. Now I can prove it valid, okay? I mean, there's no halo that appears or anything empirical. You can't do that, so we cannot prove validity. And likewise, of course, with any other sacrament, for example, with the Holy Eucharist, yes, after the consecration, you know, the bread and wine cease to exist, with only the appearances remaining, and the body, blood, soul, and divinity of our Lord are there, substantially present. But empirically, I mean, you don't see the difference, okay, unless God works a miracle, a Eucharistic miracle. Again, no sacrament can ever be proved valid because, in theory, the minister or even the recipient could secretly withhold the intention, and we would never know it, which means we must trust in divine providence. And that is really the church's position. Okay? So all we can do is outline that in a particular case, all the conditions have been met that allow and require us to presume that the sacrament is valid. And if you have any questions about that, there'll be some questions and answers at the end. So the question then is, at what point do we have sufficient grounds for presuming a sacrament valid? The church says, when the fact of the ceremony has been proved, right, when we know that the ceremony occurred, then we have to presume that the sacrament was valid. And this is amply proven, like I just mentioned, in Father Sullivan's book, Proof of the Reception of the Sacraments. If Father Sullivan goes through really the history of the church and talks about all sorts of different examples of how people proved that they had received a sacrament. I mean, there was a time in the church's history when people had to prove to their pastor that they made their Easter duty. Okay, and the pastor would keep a book, and enter that, yes, Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, made their Easter duty. And if you were away during the Easter season on travel, you had to prove to the pastor that you made your Easter duty somewhere else. Okay? In my study, on page 16, I quote Father Doheny basically to the same effect that once we know the ceremony occurred, validity is simply presumed. Now, the obligation of ensuring that the ceremony was valid is, according to canon law, canon 1002, is on the minister, okay? Whoever administers the sacrament is the one who must ensure it is valid. It's not you or me. It's not the recipient, okay? That would be on the minister, according to canon law. It's also really evident from daily liturgical life. Yeah, think about it. almost no one hears the priest pronounce the words of consecration, right? At your last Mass, did you hear Father pronounce the words of consecration? I didn't. Likewise, no one verifies that the host and the wine have the proper ingredients. Now, do they? Okay, no. Father goes, he vests, he goes up to the altar and says Mass, and we presume all that, right? We assume that the Father's going to do it, right? He's going to use the right the valid matter, and he's going to pronounce the words of consecration, and we have moral certitude that it is so. Consider also that most people don't know the formula of absolution in the confessional, right? I mean, for goodness sakes, you're saying your act of contrition, you know? Would you like a special validity witness with you in the confessional? Didn't think so. Right? Consider also you would never have any certainty of having received the sacrament of extreme unction. Sorry, I wasn't conscious. Sorry, I was sick. I really didn't hear Father say the right words, or I don't know if he used the right oils. I mean, it's getting really absurd, okay? The alternative, if this weren't true, would simply be that we would need special validity witnesses for all sorts of sacraments all the time, including confession. So we can see the church in her daily liturgical life, if the ceremony occurs, the rest is presumed. Now, if we wanted to prove the contrary, if we wanted to prove that the 1981 consecrations of Bishop Took were invalid, we would have to demonstrate the following things. Now, notice the key word is demonstrate, not insinuate, not suggest, not wonder out loud, but demonstrate that Bishop Took did not use the correct matter, the laying on of hands, or the correct form, which would be the 16-word prayer at the end of the preface when consecrating, or someone would have to demonstrate that Bishop Took did not have the intention to do what the church does. In other words, did not intend to consecrate bishops because of either ill will or distraction or insanity, okay? And this goes back to what Father Casimir was saying yesterday, right, about what's necessary to say, make a sacrament valid. So here we have the matter of the intention. So the bishop must, of course, have the intention to do what the church does, but this intention is presumed absent any evidence to the contrary. So if I wanted to demonstrate that Bishop Took did not consecrate bishops, I'd have to demonstrate, again, either that he didn't impose hands, or he didn't say the right prayer, or he didn't have the intention to do what the church does. And as far as that intention business, it would have to be externally manifested. So it would have to be something like Bishop Took would have to say before or during the ceremony, oh, we're just going through the motions. We're just playing around. You know, I don't intend to make a bishop, for example. Or some other, that would have to be some other external manifestation that he did not intend to do what the church does. And it would certainly be very hard to prove this because people are understood to intend to do what they do. In addition to that, it would also be very hard to do. How would you go through a ceremony of Episcopal consecration without intending to? That would be very difficult. It's not impossible, but I think, it's my opinion at least, I think that this withholding your intention business would be very difficult to do. I mean, you know, try to eat a meal without intending to be eating. It's very difficult, okay? Now, as far as distractions during the ceremony go, you can be distracted during the ceremony, okay? If your bishop took and, yes, you're going through the ceremony of Episcopal consecration, even your distractions, even voluntary distractions, do not nullify the intention to do as the church does unless they are so great that they become incompatible with the sacramental action. And I try to kind of simplify this. The actual technical terminology behind it is really frightening, but basically, you would have to distract yourself so much that you couldn't reasonably be said to be intending to do what you're doing. So one theologian gave an example of you'd have to be pondering complex mathematical theorems as you're, you know, imposing hands and praying this essential 16 words, okay? I never met Bishop Took, but I'm pretty sure he wasn't pondering complex mathematical theorems at the 1981 consecrations. As far as the mental state goes, mental state, that is important because you must be acting as a rational agent in order to have the intention to do what the church does. Your mental state would have to be so severely compromised that you could not form that intention. And I submit that it is impossible to go through a ceremony of Episcopal consecration, which is a very long ceremony, and not realize you're consecrating bishops, okay? And I think that's very reasonable. Now, the church says that as far as this intention business goes, the intention is hardly ever lacking in practice, okay? And this goes back to divine providence. This is how God created the church and created the sacraments, and he will see to it that, by and large, you know, the sacraments will be valid. And you can find in my study all the quotes and the backup and all of this. I just couldn't put all of that on a PowerPoint slide. So again, one would have to prove that Bishop Tuck either did or probably did any of these things here if you wanted to raise sufficient doubt regarding the validity of the consecrations, okay? Now, this proves premise one. As a quick refresher here, premise one was, once we know that the ceremony has taken place, the church requires us to presume validity. What we've just gone through proves this, so we must accept the consecrations as valid. And it's really all just very much common sense, really. The next part we have to consider is part three, lawfulness. Now that we've seen the consecrations occurred, now that we've seen that the church requires us to presume them as valid, we still have to ask, okay, but were they in accordance with the law of the church? And before we can answer that question, there's a few preliminary considerations I'd like to share with you. The church's law is called canon law. And a canon law is essentially rules, commands, and prohibitions for the conduct of the members of the church. Canon law is proposed and enacted by the rightful ecclesiastical superiors. Okay, especially the Pope. Right? The Code of Canon Law was promulgated in 1917 by the authority of Pope Benedict XV. Now, canon law will have two kinds of laws in it. Okay, some laws are divine in origin. They're divine laws. For example, there's a divine law that we must receive Holy Communion and that is necessary for salvation by necessity of precept. Okay, that is a divine law. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you shall not have life within you. Now, as I said, I don't want to confuse anybody, but it's necessary by necessity of precept. So that means it's not absolutely necessary, but it ought to be done because God has commanded it. So for those, obviously, there are many cases where it's impossible. You know, maybe babies who die just after birth, you can only baptize them. Obviously, they would still go to heaven. So these laws in the Code of Canon Law that are divine in origin are, of course, unchangeable, and the church cannot dispense from them, and that's because the church didn't make the laws. Okay, God did. So the church certainly has no authority to dispense from laws that were instituted by God. But there are other laws in the Code of Canon Law that are ecclesiastical or human in origin, and those are properly the church laws. And of course, these laws are changeable, and the church can dispense from them. The church can even do away with them entirely, at least in theory. Okay? And it's important to go through this first so that we understand what follows regarding excommunication and all these things. So we need to look at those preliminary considerations first. So what is the purpose of canon law? Why does the church have laws? Well, there's a twofold purpose. One is the proximate purpose, and that is to promote and ensure the common good of the church community at large. Okay, I think that's all very much common sense, right? The church has laws in order to regulate the conduct of her members. Okay, and the point is to ensure the common good of everybody in the church. Now, the ultimate end, though, the ultimate purpose of canon law is to facilitate and safeguard the salvation of souls, obviously. That's what the church is about. And that is what the church was commissioned to do. And so all of her laws, everything she does is directed to that ultimate end, facilitate and safeguard the salvation of souls. The church is there for souls. So now that we've looked at these preliminary considerations, we want to take a look at church law and penalties. Okay, because penalties are, in fact, a part of church law. And they are imposed by the church's authority. They can be changed or rescinded if they are ecclesiastical in nature and origin. Okay, like we were just saying, some laws are ecclesiastical in origin, and they can be changed, they can be dispensed from, they can be done away with. Same with penalties, because penalties are a part of the church's law. By the way, am I going too fast, or am I fairly good? Okay. Now, church penalties, of course, likewise have a purpose. They exist not to make life difficult for us, but rather to deter crime, punish offenses, and help reform the offender, once again, for the ultimate purpose of facilitating the salvation of souls. Right? Again, all this is very reasonable, very common sense, very, very basic, I think. Now, there are three kinds of penalties in the church. The first one is called a remedial penalty, and it is not a penalty in the strict sense, and so it's actually irrelevant to the two consecrations, and we're not gonna get into that. Then the next two kinds of penalties are going to be very important to distinguish. Medicinal penalty. A penalty can be a medicinal penalty. It is also known as a censure. Okay? And the main purpose of a medicinal penalty is to act as medicine for the delinquent. Right? It is supposed to help him reform. It's the church saying, hey, you did something wrong. We want you to repent of this. We want you to make reparation for this, and we want you to come out of that state that you're in and, you know, repent of what you've done. That is a medicinal penalty. And this is important. An example of a medicinal penalty would be an excommunication and a suspension. So when the church hurls a sentence of excommunication against someone, the point is to tell that person, you did something gravely wrong, and you're being punished now with this excommunication because we want you to come to your senses. Okay, you've done something wrong. It's not right. You need to get your act together, and until you do, you are excommunicated. And we'll get into what an excommunication is a little later. So that is what a medicinal penalty is. But that's not the only kind of penalty. You can also have a vindictive penalty. The main purpose of a vindictive penalty, unlike the medicinal penalty, is the expiation of the crime committed. It exists to chastise the offender and to redress the wrong done. Okay? And an example of this would be the privation of clerical garb. Okay? I can't think of any offenses against church law that would receive a vindictive penalty, but we'll just take a hypothetical case of a priest who has committed such an offense, and the church imposes a vindictive penalty on him. The church says, for example, you can not wear your clerical garb for the next, I don't know, 2 months, okay? And that is our punishment. It's, yes, of course, we want you to come to your senses, but regardless of whether you've already repented, you still have to, you still cannot be wearing clerical garb in order to expiate the crime, to chastise you, and to redress the wrong done, okay? So we need to keep in mind there's medicinal penalties and vindictive penalties, and the medicinal exist to help somebody come out of to help somebody repent of the grave evil done. The vindictive penalty, the main purpose there is to redress the wrong done and to expiate the crime. Now, when and how does the church impose penalties? There are two ways the church imposes penalties. One is after the commission of the offense through the intervention of the ecclesiastical superior or judge. This kind of penalty is called ferendae sententiae. Okay, and what that means is basically that the sentence, the penalty, must be imposed by the judge or by the superior. Okay, unless and until the judge or the superior imposes that penalty, it isn't incurred. Okay, and this is really what we have in secular society. You know, you have to show up in court, you did something wrong, and then until the judge gives you the sentence, you have not incurred a penalty. But then the church can impose a sentence in a different way, because the church has authority, has jurisdiction over the internal forum. Unlike society, and in the society, you're just not going to incur a penalty until the judge sentences you. But the church has jurisdiction over your soul, and so the church can impose a sentence automatically and immediately when the offense is committed. Okay? This would be without the intervention of a judge or superior. This kind of penalty is called a late sententiae penalty, as opposed to ferendae sententiae, and so it is not an imposed sentence, but an automatic sentence. It is imposed automatically, simply by committing the crime. It is more serious than a ferendae sententiae penalty, the one we discussed first, because it is incurred immediately. Okay, so that would indicate that it is more serious. There is no church trial or judgment necessary. The penalty is incurred as soon as the crime is committed. Now, for a penalty to be automatic, one of those late sententiae penalties, the church's law must specifically indicate this. Okay, otherwise, the penalty is considered ferendae sententiae. Okay? So we just said that the late sententiae is more serious. So it kind of stands to reason that unless the law of the church clearly indicates that this crime results in a late sententiae penalty, unless that is clearly stated, it will only be ferendae sententiae. Okay? Most penalties, in fact, are ferendae sententiae. Most penalties have to be imposed by an ecclesiastical superior or judge. All right, next point, we have to assess guilt. Ferendae sententiae penalties, the ones where you have to have the intervention of the superior, these are only inflicted if the putative offender is personally guilty, okay? This might seem kind of obvious, but it's important to note that the church will only render inflict a penalty if the person, the putative offender, is actually morally culpable, okay? And whether or not or to what extent somebody is morally culpable is determined at an ecclesiastical trial, right? Because really, without guilt, there can be no punishment. I mean, that only makes sense. So, you know, for example, I'm trying to think of something where, you know, you might accidentally break the law of the church and not realize it, okay? If you were a cleric and, you know, in normal times you would then be, you know, summoned before a judge, an ecclesiastical judge. If it turns out you can prove that, sorry, I really didn't realize this, either I didn't know I was breaking the law, or yes, I know I did this, but I didn't realize that this is punished, you know, with a penalty. So these are the kinds of things that would be determined at an ecclesiastical trial. Mitigating factors, as far as assessing guilt goes, include ignorance, fear, lack of the use of reason, and intoxication. And, of course, it is the judge or the superior who has the authority to determine the degree of guilt in the putative offender. All right, well, that's for ferendae sententiae penalties. for latte sententia penalties, the kind that are imposed automatically or incurred automatically and immediately upon committing the offense, the church assesses guilt as follows. Remember, there is no trial, right? There is no judge. So how do you assess guilt? Well, the church says that the full guilt is presumed until the contrary is proved in an ecclesiastical court. So at first you're going to be presumed guilty, and then, you know, you can have your case taken in front of an ecclesiastical court, and then if you can prove, and really the burden of proof is on you then, that on the delinquent, if you can prove and demonstrate that you were not culpable, or at least not fully culpable, then that is something that will be decided at a ecclesiastical trial. Okay, so you would have to prove that you did not know you were violating the law, or that you violated the law while you were, for example, on medicine that impaired the use of your reason.